Darfur. I wonder what thoughts come into your mind when you hear that word. Well, surely we recognize that they are a people who are oppressed by their government in Sudan. This is a tribal issue. It's not a religious divide, it's a tribal issue. But untold atrocities are perpetrated. There's a cry coming out, isn't there, from the people of Darfur for help and deliverance. A bit closer to home, but a little further back in history, in the 18th century, the British systematically displaced people from Africa, transported them to the British colonies, and worked them to death. British nobility and merchants grew fat and wealthy on the suffering of their slaves. Many a stately home, though thankfully not all, but many that we enjoy visiting today, are monuments to the greed and oppression by our high-ranking forefathers. The cry for freedom went up. The Negro spiritual was born out of affliction. And out of the desire for the Negroes to look for hope beyond the grave, because that grave would soon occupy them. Sadly, whilst on the positive side, men like John Newton, who wrote that hymn that we've just sung, were in the forefront of the abolition movement, the Church of England received compensation when the slave trade was abolished, because they lost the income of the Cadogan estates, which they owned. We know these things happen today and in history, and this was the situation into which Moses was born. That's exactly the type of situation that we read of in Exodus chapter 1 and 2. We can see that there was a development in the impression of the Egyptians. There's a new king. Some 400 years ago, Joseph had gone down into Egypt, and there he was the savior of Egypt. At a time of famine, through the God-given wisdom, Joseph was the deliverer of the Egyptians. 400 years on, he's forgotten. There's a new dynasty, a new pharaoh, a new king. And what's happening is the Israelites are multiplying, and suddenly there seemed to be a threat. And that culminated in what was to be, what they were seeking to do was nothing short of genocide. Now, were not the Israelites God's chosen people? Why did he let them suffer? What was God doing? Well, firstly, there is a big picture. And we can stand back and view with wonder and awe God's majesty and his majestic purposes of grace. Remember, way back, at just after the creation of the world, the man turned against God. And in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15, we read of the enmity that God says will exist between Satan and the seed of the Satan, seed of the serpent, and the woman and her seed, her spiritual seed. And so throughout the pages of the Bible and throughout history and throughout today, there is this enmity between Satan and God's people. God had chosen the Israelites to be his special people. He had set his love upon them. Through them, he was going to show the world his salvation so that all people might turn to him. He would discipline them as a father. He would woo them as a bridegroom so that they would obey, trust and love him with all their soul, with all their might, and with all their strength. This was part of God's great plan of redemption for mankind. We see the division in Genesis 3:15. We see the plan of salvation shown in Noah and the ark, Noah being saved in the ark and himself becoming a deliverer of people. We see God's plan of salvation taking another big step forward in the calling of Abraham and his descendants to be his special people. And then we see here in Exodus, God redeeming his people out of slavery. All part of this great and glorious plan of redemption that we ourselves in this day and generation enjoy. Through his dealings with the Israelites and the nations they interacted with, God would reveal his character, his purposes, and his destiny for mankind. We too live in that big picture. But how does Exodus chapter 2 fit into this big picture? Let us, as it were, zoom in a bit. And let us look at the events that we've just been reading about. To the father of the Israelite nation, Abraham, God revealed that the Israelites would be enslaved in a foreign country for 400 years. He told him that at the end of this time, God would punish the nation and bring the Israelites out with great possessions. God would lead the Israelites back to the land of Canaan, where Abraham was at the time, and use the Israelites, his servants at that time, as a means of judging the wicked and corrupt peoples of the land. In fact, God said to Abraham that the wickedness had not gone to extreme, but he knew that in the succeeding generations their wickedness would become so great that in justice they needed to be judged, and the Israelites were God's chosen people to meet that justice. God would lead his people that in a way called forth their trust and devotion as he showed his salvation, love and care for them. He would redeem them to himself. By amazing providences, as we know, the Israelites went down to live in Egypt to be saved from famine through Joseph. At first, the Israelites were welcomed by the Egyptians. After all, Joseph was their saviour. But as the Israelites came down, they were shepherds, and this was a detestable occupation for Egyptians. And so, whilst they came down into Egypt, they settled in Goshen, which is in northeast Egypt. It's just east of the Nile. As it were, right alongside, but separate from the Egyptians. No doubt, the Egyptians benefited from their produce. Over the generations, the Israelites settled into a comfortable existence alongside the Egyptians. Egypt, at the time, was the most advanced, wealthy, and powerful civilization. This was the land of the pharaohs, something like 1,000 years after the building of the pyramids. Yes, they'd had times when their power had been lessened, but now they were a powerful nation. The pharaoh was a god in this land of plenty. He was a god king. He was the means of his people getting to God. He ruled with power, and as we've seen, with increasing brutality. Now, for the Israelites, whilst there was an outward recognition of the God of their fathers, for many he had no unique claim on their obedience. Many assimilated much of Egyptian culture. We know this because we read it in Joshua chapter 24 and 14, when right at the end of his life, Joshua challenged them over the fact that they had adopted Egyptian religions. They were spiritually dulled in their time in Egypt. However, materially and numerically prospered and grew so great in numbers that the Pharaoh God King saw them increasingly as a threat. Joseph's salvation of the nation at a time of famine was now but a forgotten tale. After all, if you think about it, 400 years ago was 1600. What do we care about the nations that were aligned with us 400 years ago? We couldn't even say who they were. So this is 400 years in the past. I think in those days memories were a bit better. They're more reliant on memory than we are. But 400 years is a long time. And after all, it was a different dynasty. But as all tyrants do when perceiving a threat, Pharaoh oppressed. He oppressed the Israelites just like the people in Darfur are being oppressed today. He set taskmasters over them, forcing Israelite foremen to ensure the people built their quota of bricks so that the cities, the treasure cities he was building at the time, could be built. They were slave labor. And as I've already said, in the 17th and 18th century, the UK prospered on the back of slave labor. Still they multiplied, and an even greater perceived threat to the Egyptian God King. So he went further. He commanded that all male children were to be drowned in the Nile. Now we can see this clearly as the seed of Satan seeking to destroy the spiritual seed of the woman. If you think, hundreds of years later, Satan sought to destroy Jesus Christ through having all the children in Bethlehem murdered. But in this situation, into this desperate situation, Moses was born into a Levite family. He had an older brother, Aaron, and an older sister, Miriam. Now here we, as it were, zoom in a little bit further. Here we enter into the detail of lives. Can you imagine what it would be like for the lives of young families in those terrifying days? A wife becomes pregnant, and they would not know if their baby would be a male or a female. If it was a boy, they knew that the Egyptians were under command from the Pharaoh to put them to death. And no doubt the Pharaoh would have made sure that all the Egyptians were in fear of the Israelites, lest they should combine with an enemy and attack them and overpower them. How did God view this? Well, in their suffering, eventually we read they cry out to God. At first, when we read of their being oppressed, we don't read of them crying out to God. But eventually the pressure became so great that they couldn't do anything else but to cry out to God. And now they did. They hadn't valued the God of their fathers. They'd preferred the Egyptian gods and the life of ease that they had. But now when all that was stripped away, they had no one else to turn to, and they called to God to deliver them. Now, when nations are at war, very often, certainly in the past, and thankfully not so much now, but the leaders would just refer to, well, when you have war, blood will be spilt. Yes, we might lose thousands, tens of thousands of people. That's just casualties of war. Now, do we think that God looked upon his people as who were dying at that time, just as casualties of war? No, that is not the case. We read that God heard their cry, and it wasn't as if that he was away off, not listening, and then suddenly a cry comes up to him, and he suddenly remembers and turns his attention to them. No, he's been watching over them all this time. He cares for them. And as the individuals in their distress call to him, he meets with them where they are. We know this because we read of Job, we read of many other instances in the Bible, and we know for ourselves that we, however insignificant we feel ourselves to be, though we see that God has a great and glorious plan of salvation, we know in our own personal lives that God comes to us and meets with us and cares for us, even in the midst of our suffering, and that was true then. Satan will always use the wicked to seek to destroy God's work. Cain murdered Abel. Pharaoh sought to destroy the Israelites. Herod sought to destroy Jesus. And then we think that's all in the past. Well, in the 20th century, it's said that more Christians were put to death for their faith than in the previous 19 centuries put together. There always has been and always will be a spiritual battle. One family in particular that was focused on here was caught up in this terror. A Levite man and wife, possibly Amram and Jochebed, that's referred to later, but I'm very uncertain that those were their names, but anyway, it may have been them. They already had a daughter, Miriam, and a son, Aaron. And these births took place before this edict came out from Pharaoh. But now, Moses is born, just at this time. And when they look at this newborn son, they see that he's a fine or a good child. What does that mean? That he's good looking? Well, not necessarily. It means that he was healthy and they had a special regard for their son. Perhaps, then certainly faith is mixed here, as we read in those verses in Hebrews chapter 11. Perhaps they realized that 400 years had passed since the Israelites had entered into Egypt. And perhaps they were aware of the promise to Abraham that they will be delivered after a period of suffering. And now was the time. And perhaps even they saw something special in their son and thought, could it be that God would deliver us through our son? One thing's for sure, they were a man and woman of faith, because we're told that in Hebrews chapter 11. So, despite the king's edict, they sought to preserve his life. However, after 3 months, babies grow. Their lungs become stronger. It becomes harder and harder to hide a child in a home. So, they made a papyrus basket. It's actually called an ark in the original language, the same word as is used for Noah's Ark, and they covered it with pitch, just like Noah's Ark was. Both Noah and Moses were saved from water and went on to save God's people. The daughter Miriam watched what would happen. This little basket was placed where people passed by the river. Could it be that it was deliberately placed where royalty passed by? Maybe. But Miriam wasn't the only one watching. God was watching. And he was watching, as we know from the verses that we read, because of his covenant, because of his promise to Abraham. And then who should come by? None other than Pharaoh's daughter. Now, it's not certain which Pharaoh it was, if it was Ramesses II, as some certainly believe was a Pharaoh at the time. His daughter was one of over 100 children that he had, and of which 60 plus were daughters. So we can understand that it might not be so obvious if his daughter cared for a child, that we, with few children, would certainly notice if any grandchildren arrived on the scene. But perhaps it wasn't so obvious to him. And right at the time that Pharaoh's daughter opens the basket, Moses is crying, evoking her sympathy. Miriam uses her initiative and offers to get a Hebrew woman to nurse the baby. And not only does Pharaoh's daughter take up this offer, but even pays Moses' mother to nurse him. Now, I'm sure this is the first recorded child benefit allowance in history. It is a most remarkable turn of events, isn't it? How amazing in such details God cares and provides. And this leads us to look at the vital early years. How crucial were those early years of being nursed and brought up by his mother? What a vital role parents play. And especially mothers play in establishing children in their paths of life. It was from his mother that Moses learnt of the God of the Israelites. It was from his mother that he learnt who he was, where he'd come from, and the destiny of God's people. What he learnt at that time, in due time, gave birth to faith in God. Parents should never, ever undervalue their crucial role and influence in training up children in the way of life. Moses was to spend all his formative years being trained by the best teachers in the land of Egypt. He would be trained in history, he would be of Egypt, their supremacy, their gods, their beliefs, their values, their prejudices, their warfare, and their sciences. It was a very advanced nation. But those very first years were absolutely crucial. Now, at the beginning of the service tonight, we read from Psalm 145 and sung the psalm. And that was deliberate, as really relevant to what happened to Moses. We're encouraged there and elsewhere to naturally talk in our families about the God we know and love. God should be attractive in our homes. He should not be stern, remote, condemning, but inviting, forgiving, caring, good. We know we cannot guarantee that our children will own the God we love when they become independent adults. But if we do not tell them and show them what God is like, how will they ever know? Moses was not going to learn this in the courts of Pharaoh, and our children will not learn this in our schools or colleges. So those early years were absolutely vital in the life and faith of Moses. But then when we next read of him, he's come to maturity. He is a mature man and a strong man. He's 40 years old now. He'd been trained up, as I said earlier, in Pharaoh's court. He'd learnt all the wisdom of Egypt, as we read in Hebrews 11. It said that he was powerful in speech and action. Josephus, a Jewish historian, writes that Moses led an Egyptian army in a successful campaign against the Ethiopians. So perhaps he was a warrior, a leader. Here, at the age of 40, at the height of his powers, he visits Goshen to see how his people, the Israelites, were faring. He'd not forgotten his roots. He'd not forgotten all that he had learnt in his young years. He was now a mature man who trusted in God. And more than that, it's quite clear, he believed that God had given him the privileges he had and that he'd been raised up by God to deliver the Israelites. Now, we read that very clearly in Acts chapter 7, when Stephen, shortly before he was stoned to death, as it were, when he gave his defense against his accusers, made the statement, "Moses thought that his own people would realize that God was using him to rescue them, but they did not." In other words, Moses had very much in his consciousness, the 400 years had passed. He was in a unique position to be their leader and deliverer. And he had that sense of conviction. He had a belief in God. He with the conviction he was called by God to serve him. He had boldness and confidence. He had a sense of justice. When he saw the Israelite being beaten, his sense of justice rose up within him. And he cared for the weak and vulnerable. And what God-like qualities these are. All these are God-given gifts. And we must rejoice to see them in young, maturing people and value them in the life of the church. Do we today, we who live in a godless society that in so many ways is opposed to the God that we love, do we believe that God is able to raise up men of conviction and consecration to challenge the godlessness and deliver God's people through the proclamation of the word of God? The Israelites, some within Israel, were looking forward in hope. We must ever look forward in hope. But here, as Moses in his own mind enters in on the work that he believes he has to do for God, everything goes wrong. Everything fails. So we move on to the next stage, failure and the wilderness years. Moses, as we read, killed an Egyptian who was beating an Israelite. Now, some commentators believe that what he did was right. It was what God wanted him to do because he was acting in defense and that he didn't intend to kill. I have difficulty seeing that because we read that he looked this way and that. He wanted to be sure that no one else would see. And anyway, merely defending an Israelite by attacking an Egyptian would have resulted in Moses being a condemned man because the Israelites were nothing in the eyes of the state and Egyptians' taskmasters were to be supported. The following day, after this murder, Moses became aware, to his horror, that this thing had become public knowledge. Sure enough, Pharaoh got to know, and Moses had to flee. He'd suffered rejection by those he sought to help. He flees to Midian, northeast of Egypt. It sort of kind of overlapped the border with Egypt. The Midianites were nomadic shepherds. But there we read of him meeting up with these seven daughters of the priest of Midian. And his character comes out again, doesn't it? Because he goes to the defense of the vulnerable. Because these daughters went to feed the flock of their father and were, as obviously happened on many occasions, were pushed out of the way by the male shepherds. He went to their defense and cared for them. Now we read that these seven daughters of the priest of Midian. Now that doesn't mean that he was a godly man. In fact, in Exodus chapter 18 and verse 11, we get a clear indication that until that time he wasn't a believer in the true God. Because we read there when Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came out to meet Moses and the children of Israel after they'd come out of Egypt. And when he'd seen everything that had happened, he says, "Now I know that the Lord is greater than all other gods, for he did this to those who had treated Israel arrogantly." So again, where had Moses learnt these characteristics? Surely only from his mother in those early years. But here, out in the desert, after the court of Egypt, what an anticlimax. From a prince to a shepherd. He married Zipporah. He had two sons, one of whom he gave the name Gershom, saying, "I've become an alien in a foreign land," recognizing his status. And he lived there in a backwater for 40 years. When, at the end of his time in Egypt, He'd been looking for radical change. He was precocious. He'd taken things into his own hands. He was an action man and did what he thought from himself he had to do. But at the end of that 40 years, when we meet Moses, he's a completely different person, it seems. He is now meek. He is very humble or gentle or meek. In fact, it's said of him that he's more so than all the people who were on the face of the earth. There's only one person who was more meek than Moses, and that was Jesus Christ. Through his humiliation, he learnt humility. But clearly, and we're not going to go into this in detail, certainly some of it was dealt with last Wednesday, at the time when God met him again at that burning bush, Moses had lost his fire and his conviction. He'd experienced failure and rejection. And yes, he'd learnt meekness, but he'd lost the fire and conviction. Now, we ourselves, as we go through life, and perhaps as we go through our middle years, but actually it can start a lot earlier than that. Very often at university, Christian students can be on fire for the Lord, can be talking to others about the gospel of Jesus Christ. Maybe there are big challenges, but then they go out to work, and what they find is, and we who've been in work many years know this, that in the work situation, nobody's really interested in issues of principle. They'll talk about football, they'll talk about hobbies, they'll talk about holidays, they'll talk about the boss behind the back of the boss, all these sorts of things. But the issues of life tend to be put on the back burner. They're not interested. So it goes into this area of complacency. The excitement's gone. Complacency can take over and be very draining. Also, if we experience failure and rejection, it can lead us to resentment. Instead, we should be open to God so that he would have his work of humility with us and patience. And then, if we find we are rejected, get to that point where we value all the more that whilst we might have been deserted by our friends, we are valued by the God of creation. We are valued by the greatest person who ever walked this earth. We are valued and accepted by Jesus Christ. Moses had to spend 40 years in Midian. He's settled. He's come to accept his situation and doesn't seem to expect anything to disturb his life. For us, through all our lives, we must persevere, trusting in God. Moses lived 120 years. Now, it's said that those born after 1950 will live to 90. At least the actuaries, and George, if he was here, could confirm this, I'm sure, say that that's the statistic. For those of us who were born before 1950, I think that's a bit mean. But anyway, those who are born after 1950, you can look to live, on average, to 90. Now, on an equivalent basis to Moses, for us, that means 60. Now, this brings it very close to home. But we go on to see that with Moses, that after all these experiences, the greatest and the best is to come. Because this failure and this time of the wilderness, in the wilderness, doesn't prevent his usefulness. In fact, it's all part of his preparation. As I say, when you're getting close to 60, this becomes all very relevant. And I certainly, as I've thought about these things, you know, there are challenges that I'm having to work through in my own heart and life. As we approach this magic age, and there's several here I know are approaching, we've crossed over that boundary. What are your expectations? Retirement, hobbies, family, relaxation, holidays, projects to work on, the to-do list. That's a good reason for postponing retirement. We live in a culture that does not respect mature people. Although I think that's going to change because purchasing power passes to them, as it will do in the next 10 years, I think we'll find a lot more attention. Youth is important. It's vital in the church. We should rejoice when young men and women step forward to serve the Lord. But youth isn't everything. There is a wisdom that should come with experience of God over the years, just as it did with Moses. For Moses, this stage of life meant starting the most exciting, demanding, humiliating time of his life. Both Egypt and Midian were vital training grounds for the work that he was about to engage in. And all our past, our successes, our going forward, yes, and our failures and our times in the wilderness, all serve their place in our spiritual lives and progress. To undertake this work he was about to embark on, he needed leadership skills. He needed to know his way about the court of Egypt. He needed courage. He needed perseverance. He needed to be able to cope with failure and rejection, because he was going to see plenty of that. He needed to know his way about the desert, how to live a nomadic life, and he needed conviction. He was just the man for the time. God had prepared him for the now. But he didn't want to accept it, as he realized it was going to be hard, and he lacked any sense of self-confidence. Those of us who matured through the pivotal 1960s that saw such radical changes in society that are coming to their full fruition now, what will we do in retirement? Exit stage left gracefully. What will be the topic of our conversations in our retirement? Our health, our hobbies, our family, our grandchildren. We've had our grandchildren with us today. It's lovely having them. Our holidays. Do we see that God still has a work for us to do? We want to see future leaders emerge in the church. How desperately we need them, the young men. But we have a role to support, to encourage, to enable and advise. Perhaps we will have more time to help others. Perhaps we can look out into the community in which we are set to see where the heartaches are and seek to help. Perhaps even for those who are engaged in forms of ministry, we could help as a research base. Now, our minds will probably be only a fifth as fast as theirs, but we've probably got 20 times the amount of time. So perhaps we can be a help in that. We do not have to take the limelight. We can do the backroom work, but let us do that. And above all, we can pray for the future of the church. At whatever stage we are in life, we have a call from God to serve him where we are, using the gifts and the strengths and drawing on the experience that God has given us. There is never an end to our spiritual lives until we step over into heaven. Let us be challenged by Moses. Let us be excited by him. Let us look forward to see that our greatest service to Christ and the church may yet be ahead of us wherever we are in the life of the church. God is in the big picture. God is in the details of the picture. Our lives are not lost in God going for the big event. Our lives count for the big event. May the Lord help us. Amen.